Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. Okay. This is week one. This is week one of our bi-weekly issue. And in a dramatic change of pace, I'd like to read you The Brief and The View, which I usually read on week two, and that's because this edition of Time, the May 11th edition, is the top 100 most influential companies. And since the last 2 weeks, we were reading the top 100 most influential people, I thought you might like a little change of pace, get some actual news, and we'll catch up with the top 100 most influential companies next week. So I'm going to start with The Brief. And our first story in The Brief is Oil's Slippery Future. The energy lesson behind Iran's control over the Strait of Hormuz, and this is by Justin Worland. It's been hard following the minute-by-minute, day-by-day developments in energy markets triggered by the Iran war, let alone distilling the signal from all the noise. Oil takes big swings up and down on the basis of President Trump's latest Truth Social post or off-the-cuff comments. The April 17th announcements from Iran that the Strait of Hormuz would open to commercial traffic boosted the stock market and sent oil prices tumbling, only to reverse course as both the U.S. and Iran turned hostile once again. With this conflict, no matter the short-term headline, the direction for energy costs further out remains murky. Even so, it may still be possible to make some predictions. We can already see what it will look like: long-term structural volatility. The world has woken up to a new baseline of instability in the Middle East that won't go away so long as the current regime in Iran remains and the country can control or simply block the Strait of Hormuz. And that instability is bound to create price fluctuations. Bob McNally, the energy analyst who founded the Rapidian Energy Group, describes the closing of the Strait of Hormuz as the loss of a key foundation of modern energy markets. Without the strait being reliably open, the whole system creaks and is bound to swing dramatically up and down. A load-bearing assumption in energy until February 28th, or a few days into the fighting, was that the United States will never allow anyone to restrict commercial flow through the Strait of Hormuz, he told me. This is without precedent. McNally, who wrote the book Crude Volatility, argues that oil markets have depended throughout history on a stabilizer to keep price fluctuations from getting out of hand. From the 1930s to the 1960s, the Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates the state's oil industry, effectively set oil prices globally by creating production limits. More recently, OPEC took on that role as its 12 members worked together to set production limits in their own countries, thereby controlling the price. The Iran war has reminded the world of what ensues when no one is there to play that role. Closing the Strait of Hormuz limits the ability of OPEC's most important member states, like Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, to get their product to market. That in turn limits OPEC's ability to stabilize oil prices. In short, we all need to prepare for persistent price volatility baked into the structure of the energy system, likely for years to come. Even if the strait opens in the short term, Iran has shown that it can control the waterway whenever it chooses. And the mere possibility of a closure is enough to generate uncertainty. So what does the future of energy look like if such volatility is part of the equation? Many people have spent much of the past month considering where energy prices may go and how that pricing will flow through to other fuels and power sources. But even without the guarantee of a persistently high price, volatility on its own has a way of shaping markets. It's long been understood that oil price volatility slows capital spending broadly and at individual firms. Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve from 2006 to 2014, made the case in a seminal 1983 paper, "Firms Postpone Irreversible Investment Decisions When Uncertainty Rises." The act of waiting has value. A 2019 study looking across 54 countries confirmed the effect at the company level. Of course, the context was different just a decade ago. Hydrocarbon alternatives were limited and speculative. Today, a wide swath of clean technologies are commercially available and ready to deploy. At the prospect of dramatic oil and gas price fluctuations may be enough to convince investors that there is a market for clean energy free of those swings. In conversations in the past 2 weeks, I heard just that investors don't know exactly what's to come, but they feel assured that alternative fuels and power sources have a path to market. And yet the public markets don't really reflect that. Stocks have brushed aside the prospect that turmoil in the region will persist much longer, counting on Trump to back off the hostilities. Oil prices, while high compared to just a few months ago, still suggest that investors think that a resolution is coming soon. But that's a tall ask, and the energy wake-up call may already be happening. Cooking fuel is unacceptable in parts of Asia. Jet fuel is running low in Europe. Fuel prices are higher globally. Even though the United States has been somewhat insulated, the country will begin to send more hydrocarbon products to other markets, leaving the costs to rise at home. At the spring meeting of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and World Bank in Washington in April, the IMF warned of slowing growth and that downside risks dominate. The economic outlook, we've been sort of in la-la land, says McNally. Well, la-la land ends this month. Our next story in the brief, folks, is what we know about the White House's underground bunker. A court challenge to President Trump's massive new White House ballroom has thrown a public spotlight onto the supposedly secret complex beneath. In the fall, the Trump administration began demolishing the east wing of the White House to make way for the president's $400 million ballroom. The National Trust for Historic Preservation filed a lawsuit against Trump and members of his administration, arguing that the construction was unlawful. After months of litigation, a judge ordered on March 31st that the ballroom construction project must stop until Congress authorizes its completion, but left open the possibility that some work could continue if it was necessary to ensure the safety and security of the White House. The Trump administration now argues that the project isn't an important national security upgrade, saying that it wants to rebuild the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, PEOC, a secure, underground bunker that has long been an open secret in Washington, D.C. Built underneath the now demolished East Wing of the White House during World War II, the PEOC was intended to provide security for top White House officials. During the chaos of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, several officials, including then Vice President Dick Cheney, were escorted into the bunker. On April 16th, the judge ordered a halt to all above-ground work without congressional approval, but permitted the White House to continue construction underground, including on the military complex. The Trump administration had shared little information about its plans for the facility. On March 29th, the president told reporters that the ballroom essentially becomes a shed for what's being built under. A few days later, he said that the construction project was necessary for the safety and security of the White House, adding that the administration is building bomb shelters and a hospital and very major medical facilities. Administration officials have said that some aspects of the project are of a top secret nature. And this is by Chantel Lee. Continuing with the stories in the brief, folks, we have what happens if banks start collecting citizenship details? And this is by Connor Green. American banks may soon be required to collect citizenship information from customers. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said at the Semaphore World Economy Summit on April 15th, and an executive order is already in process that would mandate that banks gather such information. I don't think it's unreasonable because why don't we have information on who's in our banking system? I have a place in the UK and they want to know who lives in every apartment, he said. And how do we know that it's not part of a foreign terrorist organization? When asked for further information regarding the order, White House official told Time that the administration continues to explore ways to protect our banking system from unacceptable credit risks and to ensure that banking services remain available and affordable for all Americans. Administration did not confirm details on what citizenship information the executive order would require banks to collect, or whether it would be reported to the government. Nor is it clear if the order would prevent non-citizens from opening new accounts or require banks to shut accounts of existing customers who couldn't produce citizenship documents, though sources said that told Semaphore that the order would apply to them. And the executive action is likely to face legal challenges. Already, though, experts say the impact of such a requirement could be wide-ranging, potentially creating hurdles for the United States banking system as well as for non-citizens and citizens alike. The exact number of non-citizens who own bank accounts in the United States is unknown. But a 2023 report from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, showed that 96% of United States households, or roughly 128 million homes, were banked, meaning at least one member of the household had a checking or savings account at a bank. A report from the Census Bureau, meanwhile, estimated that as of 2022, 46.2 million United States residents, almost 14%, were foreign-born, nearly half of whom had not been naturalized as citizens. Efren Olivares, Vice President of Litigation and Legal Strategy at the National Immigration Law Center, notes that if non-citizens were unable to access U.S. banks, the economy could also take a hit. A lot of people who are not citizens, who are here on business visas, on tourist visas, on investor visas, do not have citizenship and are not local permanent residents, but they bring millions and millions and probably billions of dollars to this country's economy, he says. A portion of American citizens could also be shut out of banks if such a requirement were put in place. A 2023 Brennan Center for Justice survey found that roughly 21.3 million voting-age citizens, or 9.1%, don't have documents proving their citizenship easily available. Depending on how this executive order reads, Olivares says, it may really prevent many U.S. citizens who do not have a passport, do not have a driver's license, or do not have a valid ID from opening up a bank account. Privacy is another concern. The Trump administration has drawn criticism for its moves to share data between federal agencies. Trump has sought to increase that data sharing since early in his second term, signing an executive order in March of 2025 that sought to eliminate information silos and allow agency heads to have full and prompt access to all unclassified agency records, with the stated intention of stopping waste, fraud, and abuse. If agencies that work with banks gain access to citizenship data, then the information may spread elsewhere. If they can require banks to demand in some ways and hold private personal information for lots of folks, it raises the specter that the government may go after that and use it abusively to track down and harass people in communities, says Eric Rodriguez, Senior Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at Unidos, a Latino civil rights organization. If users' private banking information were accessed by the federal government, he says, banks could also be held liable for violating laws that safeguard customers' personal information. The potential order, he argues, would almost de facto put banks in a position to somehow enforce immigration laws. We are moving into milestones now, folks, and our first milestone is Viktor Orban has been ousted. Hungary's Viktor Orban's era ended on April 12th, when the prime minister was voted out of office after 16 years of illiberal rule. Voters emphatically rejected Orbán's far-right movement amid corruption scandals, giving the opposition Tisza party, led by Peter Magyar, a two-thirds majority in parliament. Speaking to Time ahead of the election, Susanna Vey, a political analyst at the German Marshall Fund, says that Tisza's success had created a realistic chance to potentially reform the country and to halt the autocraticization that we'll have seen over the past decade and a half, and return to a more democratic way of governance. Magyar, a conservative who was previously part of Orban's Fidesz party before splitting off in 2024, has pledged to implement an anti-corruption reforms in the country, saying that he would restore the rule of law and give government institutions more independence. He has also promised to tackle issues such as public health and education. Whether he will follow through remains to be seen, but Vey noted that with a two-thirds majority, he would have almost a free hand to actually reform the country. If Magyar upholds his pledge to implement reforms that could also help repair Hungary's relationship with the European Union, which has grown increasingly strained under Orbán's leadership. In 2022, the EU began spending billions in funding Hungary's over violations in its rule of law standards. The increase in that funding would not only help the nation's struggling economy, but also send a positive signal to voters in other member states where right-wing populists are challenging EU standards. In an interview on April 16th with the Patriota YouTube channel, Orbán indicated that he wouldn't step down from leading Fidesz, but said the party was in need of a complete renewal. And this is by Chantel Lee. And we have Eric Swalwell resigning in disgrace. Fortune changed over a weekend for Eric Swalwell, a popular U.S. representative and frontrunner in California's race to succeed Governor Gavin Newsom, before reports of sexual misconduct allegations by multiple women surfaced. Days later, on April 14th, Swalwell resigned from Congress following threats of expulsion from the House colleagues and pressure from fellow Democrats, and he suspended his gubernatorial campaign. Swalwell has adamantly denied the allegations, including rape, sexual assault, and sending unsolicited nudes. He apologized for his so-called mistakes in judgment, although he has vowed to challenge the accusations legally. With the primary on June 2nd, Swalwell's exit from the gubernatorial race left Democrats without a clear frontrunner, while simultaneously improving Republican prospects. California is deep blue, but under its single ballot primary, the top two finishers advance to the November ballot regardless of party. And with the Democratic vote divided among a half a dozen candidates and only two Republicans in the race, one of them, former Fox News host Steve Hilton, led in some polls in a week after the shakeup. And agreed by the Trump administration on April 13th to fly the Pride flag on a federal flagpole at the Stonewall National Monument in New York City, 2 months after it took the rainbow flag down. And one more note in milestones, imposed a cap of 2,708 daily flights at Chicago O'Hare International Airport this summer, a cut of as many as 372 flights per day by the Federal Aviation Administration on April 16th to help prevent widespread flight delays amid construction. Our next story is some good advice. This spring, stop and smell a flower by Angela Haupt. Whoever first suggested stopping to smell the roses was onto something, but there's a catch. Not all roses smell good to all people. Our response to scent is deeply personal, shaped by memory, culture, and even genetics. What matters more than what you sniff is figuring out which smells resonate and then giving yourself enough time to experience them. Deliberately sniffing something is almost like an act of mini protest, says Kate McLean McKenzie, a designer and researcher at the University of Kent in the UK, who maps smellscapes around the world. It's like, I'm not going to just look at it. I'm actually going to bend down and sniff it. People will look at you strangely. But when you do, your heart rate slows, your nervous system shifts, and your mood lifts. Olfaction is among the oldest of our sensory systems. It evolved long before the cortex, the brain structure responsible for rational thought, overdeveloped research indicates. Part of what makes scent so powerful is how differently the brain processes it compared with other senses. Mood change is one of the more common effects of smelling something, says Pamela Dalton, a cognitive psychologist with the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, a nonprofit research institute. Olfaction has a more direct impact on emotion than any other sense. When you inhale, odor molecules bind to receptors in your nose and travel to the olfactory bulb in the brain. Unlike touch, hearing, or vision, which all pass through a relay station called the thalamus before we're conscious of them, smell skips that step, connecting straight to the limbic system. That's the brain's emotional center where memories live. Here's how to tap the power of scent at home. Number one, luxuriate in scent for at least 30 seconds. There's a difference between a passing sniff and an intentional one. Spend at least 30 seconds actually calming your system down and really inhaling and thinking about it, McLean McKenzie advises. It's not a long time, but it's possibly more time than most people give it. Try smell catching in your neighborhood. McLean McKenzie leads smell walks in which small groups walk a short distance and pay special attention to what they smell. You can do the same on your own, and you don't need a curated route. Just walk slowly and wait for scents to come to you. Inhale deeply when something catches your attention. Challenge yourself to get low, get close, and engage with the environment the way an animal would. Rotate your scents by mood. Sweet, powdery floral scents, think lavender and rose, trigger relaxation and a calmer mood. Citrus, pine, mint, and other sharp or cooling scents tend to be more energizing. Scent has these effects partly through the trigeminal nerve, Dalton says, which registers sensation as well as smell. That can shift your mood because it's part of the touch system in your body, but it happens to be in your nose, she says. So when you smell something strong enough, it will activate both the smell system and also the other touch system, and that sensation can be arousing. Choosing your scent based on the headspace that you seek. Switch off your screen and your brain. One great thing about bending down to sniff the daffodils is that you can't do it on a screen. Digitally, you can't transmit a smell, McLean McKenzie says. It means you have to engage with the outside world or be able to get the best experience from it. As you detach from your screen, try quieting your thoughts as well. A smell walk is meant to be an embodied, holistic experience, she says. It's about trying to rationalize it all at the time, but actually just responding. Your associations are your own, and what matters is that you notice them. Pay attention to what changes. Smell is also a health signal. Shifts in how things smell to you, or a sudden loss of scent, can be early indicators of illness worth flagging to a doctor. Head injuries, conditions like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease, and run-of-the-mill colds and sinus infections can all contribute. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds. This is the May 11th issue of Time Magazine. We've just finished reading the brief, and we're moving on now to The View. And our first story in The View is Birthday Wishes, and this is by John Garrison Marks. Our disagreements about the history of slavery are never simply about the past. They are about what we believe America is, what it stands for, and who belongs within it. The nation has never been one thing to all people, and our commemorations inevitably reflect that reality. But federal planners for the semi-quincentennial clearly have little interest in acknowledging the central place of slavery in American history. Under President Donald Trump's leadership, statues of enslavers have been brought to Washington, D.C., while the administration trumpets projects like the Founders Museum and traveling freedom trucks that minimize or ignore the founders' involvement in slavery. Exhibits and publications about slavery have been removed from National Park Service's sites, and grants that explore the history of the institution have been cut. And Freedom 250, the initiative leading the White House's anniversary celebration, gives short shrift to the impact of slavery, and this is not new. The 1932 George Washington Bicentennial offers a particularly revealing precedent. Planning began in 1926 with a nationwide address from President Calvin Coolidge, broadcast to what was then the largest radio audience in American history. Coolidge argued that earlier generations had placed Washington on a pedestal, transforming him into a rather imaginary character shaped by a universal desire to worship his memory. The result, he warned, was that the real man among men had been obscured. Over the next 6 years, Americans set out to rediscover the real George Washington. The scale of the effort was staggering. Newspapers published millions of articles. An estimated 16,000 commemorative programs took place every day during the nine-month celebration. Washington's presence saturated American life in a way unmatched before or since. Yet, amid this flood of programming, the mostly all-white planning bodies erased Washington's involvement with slavery. The African-American activists, intellectuals, and scholars shared their own visions of Washington's legacy. W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, published a pageant, a common form of sharing lessons from Washington's life during his bicentennial, that placed Washington's enslaving front and center. One scene depicts Washington taking a roll call of the people he enslaved at Mount Vernon, while in another, Washington is upstaged by black patriots of the American Revolution. Scholar Walter H. Mazyck's 1932 book, George Washington and the Negro, was likely the first devoted to Washington's history with race and slavery. The George Washington Bicentennial may canonize St. George on his 200th anniversary, wrote Carl Murphy, publisher of the Baltimore Afro-American, but the facts is you'll prefer Mr. Mazyck's book. These interventions were not simply about collecting the historical record. They were efforts to use the past to demand that Americans confront the realities of racial injustice in their own time, particularly the violence, disenfranchisement, and denial of civil rights so common in the era of Jim Crow. By centering slavery in their interpretations of Washington, Black Americans sought to claim a fuller place in the national story and to press for a more just future. Even with the full weight of the federal government behind them, federal planners still couldn't eliminate the discussion of slavery from the anniversary. No single top-down narrative was able to silence competing interpretations of the past. Americans argued, challenged, and reshaped the meaning of the commemoration in real time. We have the same possibilities today. Across the country, history organizations and community groups are planning their own efforts to mark the 250th anniversary. A new exhibit opened at George Washington's Mount Vernon that encourages visitors to engage with Washington's history of enslavement. The Declaration Book Club, hosted by Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, explores the history and legacy of the Declaration of Independence without shying away from the centrality of slavery to Jefferson's and the nation. Even the center-right American Enterprise Institute's We Hold These Truths initiative thoughtfully engages with the contradiction between the soaring idealism of the founders and their deep involvement in the institution of slavery. Our history makes it clear that anniversaries do not belong to governments alone. They belong to all of us. No administration, institution, or single group of planners can fully define what the past should mean for the people of the present. Next in the view is the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. No one should doubt Xi Jinping's determination to bring the island of Taiwan under Beijing's direct control during his tenure as China's leader. Over the 14 years that he served as China's president, he has publicly pledged many times to bring that day forward. We should not assume, however, that he means to move soon. Yes, the United States, Taiwan's indispensable ally, is now mightily distracted by the war in the Middle East. The U.S. president knows that many millions of American voters want fewer, not more, foreign entanglements for United States soldiers and sailors. But Xi has seen how both Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran have produced unpleasant surprises, much higher costs, and potential domestic political dangers for Presidents Putin and Trump, despite the clear superiority of Russian and American war-making capabilities. Taiwan has received more than enough American military hardware over the years to make war especially costly, and Taiwan's government, like those of Ukraine and Iran, has all the advantages that come with forces motivated by survival. Xi also knows that his forces lack the crucial asset of battlefield experience. China has not fought a shooting war since a brief 1979 clash with Vietnam that produced mixed results, and a direct attack on Taiwan would involve crossing 100 miles of water by a Chinese navy that has never fought a naval battle. There's also reason to doubt that President Xi trusts his military leadership, a point made public by his purges in recent years of a number of senior officers as well as state officials with ties to them. For all these reasons, China's leader is far more likely to order an economically strangling naval quarantine around the island in an attempt to force Taiwan to capitulate without the risks that come with war. If that's the case, today's fear over the continued flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz would look modest next to China's ability to block the transit of the world's most sophisticated semiconductors, more than 90% of which are produced on the island of Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. These chips are essential to a big percentage of the world's digital age consumer goods and military hardware. And yet, given the stakes for China and the world, a quarantine is not imminent either. Instead, Xi is focused for now on influencing Taiwan's January 2028 presidential election in hopes of helping defeat the current president, William Lai, no friend of Chinese communists. In April, we got a glimpse of what that strategy might look like. President Xi met in April with Cheng Li Wan, chairwoman of the more Beijing-friendly opposition Kuomintang, KMT, and 2 days later, China unveiled a set of new ideas to promote tighter cross-straits cooperation, including institutionalization of Beijing's communication with the KMT, a resumption of cross-strait direct flights and tourism, the import of Taiwanese agriculture and fishery products, and other practical steps. The hope is that tying these various offerings to the KMT leader's trip to the mainland will give Taiwanese voters new reason to back the opposition. Not surprisingly, the incumbent Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, dismissed these overtures as a sugar-coated bomb and accused Beijing of working around Taiwan's popularly elected government in hopes of dividing Taiwanese society. The DPP made no move to restore an official government-to-government cross-strait dialogue frozen since 2016. The KMT, meanwhile, has responded to this latest surge of friction by urging the DPP administration to respond constructively to goodwill from the mainland. Whether any of China's offers are accepted is beside the point. Xi intends to cast Taiwan's President Lai as a troublemaker and an obstacle to a mutually profitable reunification. For now, China's tactics are unlikely to yield a breakthrough. But the island's election is 21 months away. Xi is inclined to wait for Taiwan's voters to cast their ballots and then see what opportunities the result might create. Moving along with the view stories, folks, we next have Climate is Everything, and this is by Simone Shaw. Political independents are increasingly worried about climate change, according to the latest Gallup Environment poll, conducted in March and released in April. While Republicans overwhelmingly discount warnings that the planet is warming, the 46% of independents who now say that the effects of global warming are underestimated is a new high. Independents also account for the record low share of U.S. adults, 35%, who say that they feel positively about the environment. Unaligned voters expressing that sentiment fell 10% since 2025. Views on global warming, while always political, have grown extreme as the weather. Just 6% of Republicans say they worry a great deal about climate change. That contrasts with 72% of Democrats and 44% of independents whose views on climate have risen and fallen with those of Democrats, while Republicans have increasingly echoed the climate denialism reflected in President Donald Trump's policies. In 2001, slightly more than half of Republicans attributed global warming to human activities, and today only 28% do. Given the partisan variance, the changing views of independents move the needle. The 44% of U.S. adults who worry a great deal about global warming and climate change now approach the peak 46% measured in 2020 and 45% in 2017. A lot of different topics that we cover have also seen similar shifts among independents in the last year or two, says Gallup senior editor Megan Brennan. I think it's somewhat emblematic of the popularity of the president and how well people perceive the job that he is doing. Our next article is In the Loop, and this is by Nikita Ostrowski, an editorial fellow. Quantum computers capable of breaking the encryption protocols that secure the internet may arrive sooner than expected, thanks to a new paper published by quantum computing startup Oritonic that has alarmed cybersecurity researchers. AI was instrumental to the advance, according to Oritonic. Quantum computers are built from quantum bits, or qubits, which use the counterintuitive laws of quantum mechanics to perform certain calculations much faster than is possible with ordinary computers. That speed poses a threat to internet security. Everything from WhatsApp messages to top secret documents rely on the fact that it would take the most powerful supercomputer much longer than the age of the universe to break their encryption. A quantum computer, however, could do the same work in days. Almost every system in the world becomes vulnerable altogether to a quantum attacker, says Bas Westerbaan, a cybersecurity researcher at Cloudflare. Today's quantum computers are too small to be dangerous, but a 2025 survey found a 39% chance of this changing in the next decade as quantum computers grow more powerful and the algorithms they run become more efficient. The U.S. National Institute for Standards and Technology has set a 2035 deadline to prepare for their arrival. Oritonic's result, together with a paper published concurrently by Google, could significantly shorten the development time of a quantum computer that threatens encryption, according to multiple experts who spoke to Time. The work has not yet been peer-reviewed. The world is currently, in my view, not prepared, says Dolly Bluestein, co-founder of Oritonic, which aims to build the first useful quantum computer. He said members of the team briefed U.S. officials on the findings before publication. Oritonic used an AI that combined past scientific results in a novel way, demonstrating understanding of niche subdisciplines in quantum computing as it tried thousands of different ideas. It helped the researchers find an algorithm that reduces the number of qubits required to build a dangerous quantum computer by 100 times. There is no question that we used AI to accelerate this development, says Bluestein. No question at all. Folks, next we have the View essay, and the title of this is The Myth of the Adult Friend Group. I grew up watching TV shows like Friends and Sex and the City, which glamorized a tight-knit group of friends to hang out together as adults almost daily. I have spent my whole adult life trying to chase that fantasy, but it's never materialized. I have a friend I meet for dinner only. I have another friend I play tennis with, and a different one for dance classes. When I combine them together at a dinner party, in the hopes that they become friends with each other, it never worked out. Either they didn't have anything in common, and it's awkward, or they have so much in common that I get pushed out and they start hanging out without me. I remember being so jealous when a guy I dated celebrated his birthday 3 times with 3 different friend groups, once with childhood friends, once with university friends, and once with work friends. Here I was, desperately trying to curate at least 1 friend group that could be consistent, and he had 3. How unfair. But research shows that the tensions that many adults feel around friendship may stem less from personal failure and more from how social connections actually work in adulthood. One recent survey found that 59% of people wish that they had a larger social circle, while 20% report struggling with loneliness. Other research shows that people who have close confidants report higher life satisfaction and lower rates of depression. This points to a mismatch between expectation and reality. The cultural idea of a cohesive friend group may be harder to sustain than we imagine. In practice, emotional well-being often depends on maintaining a few reliable, intimate relationships. That might help explain why many adults naturally gravitate toward one-on-one or dyad friendships. To understand this from a psychological perspective, I reached out to Suzanne Degas-White, a licensed counselor and relationship expert at the personal growth app Headway, and professor and chair of the Counseling and Higher Education Department at Northern Illinois University. She told me that if we strip away the polished version of friendship portrayed on TV, then we would see that it's easier to maintain reciprocity between 2 friends than it is in larger groups. Dyad friendships allow you to learn more about one another at a much deeper level, and this increases understanding and empathy between friends, Degas-White told me. This also allows friends to have a clearer understanding of one's needs, such as being heard, being seen, and interested and supported. In the absence of external noise from a group, she added, minor tensions are easier to talk through and resolve. We also have cognitive limits on maintaining stable relationships, which explains why deep connections are sustained in smaller, more focused interactions rather than in groups. A 2023 Pew Research Center survey showed that a majority of adults, 53%, say they have 1 to 4 close friends, 38% said they have 5 or more friends, and 8% said they have no close friends. These findings reinforce the idea that adult friendships are usually about investing deeply in a few meaningful friendships. Quality matters more than quantity. When I'm in a big group of friends, I often find myself performing, trying to be the funniest or the most clever or to get validation from the group. And then, at times, being in a group has been so overstimulating that I would barely say a word. In one-to-one friendships, I am the most comfortable. It's only in that emotional climate and that intimate safe space that I have been able to be vulnerable and discuss my fears as well as my deepest thoughts. Opening up deeply in a group can change the dynamic, especially if no one else is able to do so, explained Degas-White. Vulnerability can be compromised if the person turns the topic into a joke or another says they must stay silent or isn't fully engaged. I have often feared rejection in group dynamics. We, as humans, are wired for one-on-one intimacy. I realized recently that I was chasing the wrong structure this entire time, because when I look at the friendships that have really sustained me, the ones where my friends have seen me ugly, seen me cry over a breakup, or have come over to help me move, they have always been one-on-one. We're often taught to measure our social lives by how many people we can gather in a room, but quality matters over quantity. Just like in romantic relationships, friendship is just two people choosing each other over and over. And the author Barta is a journalist currently working on a memoir dealing with friendships and love. And folks, that does it for Time Magazine for today. This was The Brief and The View. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. Next week, we'll be doing the top 100 influential companies. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.